Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Community in Depth. Oh, you know what? Can I tell you? I'm so grateful that these two wonderful women on the other end of the phone take the time to really get the word out and be transparent about what is going on in the world in regards to COVID. We hear a lot of things in a lot of different from a lot of different sources, but it's really nice to boil it down to specific to this area and really hear about what is going on in the Hastings and surrounding communities. And we're grateful that we have on the phone with us Helen Strike. She is the president of the River Falls Hospital and the Regina Hospital in Hastings. And also we're joined by Dr. Melody McKenzie. She's the primary care lead physician, and she's also the Regina's director of medical affairs. And we are grateful for both of your time. So thank you so much for calling in today. Helen, let's start with you, please. I know that recently the governor has turned the dial, or whatever the phrase is, and we are now able to open up a little bit some of the long-term care facilities. Can you speak to that, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So just a week or so ago, the governor began to think about how can we loosen up a little bit, knowing all the time that we may have to dial back down again, but let's get some things happening, just get more kindness happening out there in terms of our senior population. So he did open up the ability for our long-term care facilities to be able to have minimal visitors, but at least visitors, which is a good thing. Everyone has, in every system, similar to acute care hospitals, has their own rules and their ways at which they are putting this into place. But here at Regina Senior Living, they're opening up to allowing one visitor in per day, which is a good thing. The hospital, we've also lessened the restrictions. And between 10 and 8 every day, our inpatients are able to have one visitor per day signed in to stay with them. They can come and go, but only that one person for the day. For our other areas like imaging and surgery, and one visitor is allowed per adult. Two guardian or parents are allowed per child. So, Melody, have we increased visitors at the clinic too?
So we are allowing one person to come in with people if they want. We're still encouraging people to try and come in by themselves. Likewise, if it's a well child, one parent, but we will allow two. If they have no daycare, so if it's a mother who has three kids and one has a well child and the other two have to come in tow, we usually encourage them to find someone else to look after their other two, but we understand that sometimes that's not possible. So we do make exceptions. We try and minimize it. So we do the best we can. We're being a little bit more flexible than before when we had to shut everything down.
So right now, because the dial is being turned, we have to be extra careful, don't we? So we don't go backwards.
Yeah, I think now it becomes an individual family responsibility to help with the momentum that we've made over the last 4 months. And with all our stay-at-home orders and all of the if we're not careful as individuals with social distancing and washing our hands and wearing a mask inside, that we really are in a situation where we're going to make those dials turn back. So it's important for each one of us to really take this seriously.
Helen, what is the state of where we are now, please?
Well, right now, probably because the 4th of July was a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago really, which is about those 14 days, we're starting to see more positive cases in Minnesota. We've actually come off the list of the lowest spread in the country, and we're in moderate spread now of COVID. You might have heard today that the New York State has listed Minnesota and Wisconsin as two states at which they will require 14-day quarantine for if you come to New York. So we're not in as good a shape as we were in terms of spread of the virus. But the interesting part of what we're experiencing is we're not seeing an increase in hospitalization, and our deaths are still single digit, which they have been for the last week. So we're seeing positive news there, positive news on the intensive care front. We have numbers that are similar to the beginning of April right now, but we don't want to turn that dial back to having our ICUs getting full and hospitalizations increasing. So once again, up to all of us to make sure that if we do have symptoms, that we get tested, if we're concerned, if we've been around people who've been positive and had exposure with more than 15 or 20 minutes in less than 3 with them, and we haven't been washing our hands or wearing a mask, that we get tested, because I may be asymptomatic or have minimal symptoms, but I may come into contact with a vulnerable person without realizing. So we're back again at individual responsibility.
So what do you think those numbers mean if we have an increase in cases but not as many deaths or hospitalizations? Is it because we're doing more testing?
Well, that's always part of it. But the biggest thing we know right now is we see in the numbers that a lot of these people that are testing positive are the young adults and the teens, which is not to be unexpected. They tend to be around more people. They tend to sit closer to each other and be in larger groups. So it's much easier for them to spread the virus. We also know, however, that teenagers and young adults tend not to get very sick with it. So it's not unexpected that these younger people aren't going to the emergency room. They're not ending up in ICU. They're not ending up in ventilators. The biggest concern is how much they can spread it to each other. And then as they spread it to each other, then they spread it to other people who are more vulnerable. I know Helen and I were talking about next week, starting to think about what might happen in the next few weeks, because Helen's job and my job is to think ahead. So what's going to happen as these teenagers and young adults give it to people who are more vulnerable, and what will that do to the clinic and to the hospital and to the community? So this is the important thing. It's not as much what other people are doing right now is what these young people are doing, and to have them thinking about not just themselves but public health. Public health is doing things for everyone else. So it's hard. They need to be busy. We want them to be in sports. You know, Raiders Express is going, swim team is going, baseball's starting up. So anything we can do to try and protect them, to minimize the hugs and the fist pumps, and just trying to be really careful and making sure that they're doing what they can do to minimize spread.
What is the protocol if we think we've had a possible exposure?
So we know that it can take time for people to show symptoms, and some people don't show any symptoms. So that's the difficult thing. So if we've had a close exposure, if it's a family member or a coworker beside us and we're not socially distanced, the actual recommendation is actually quarantine initially. Most people will have symptoms or turn a positive test within, you know, 10 to 11 days, so it can take a while. So socially distancing, quarantining is the most important thing if we've had an exposure. And then if we have symptoms, is to go and get tested. We know curbside testing. Helen and I, we've been noticing there's more and more testing, which is wonderful. We want people to test. River Falls and Hastings here, we're testing about 100 people a day at each site. So we're doing lots of testing, which is great. And I would encourage anyone, if they have any symptoms, if they're not sure, they should get tested. And then just as important, while they're waiting for that result, they need to stay at home, because there's nothing more disheartening than someone tests and then they go to a whole bunch of places and we call them 3 days later and they haven't been quarantining in that whole time they've been spreading the virus around.
When is a person contagious?
Well, that's best question ever. We don't know. We know some things, and again, we learn more all the time. So we know that people are most contagious right around the time they start having symptoms, and possibly before, and probably that first week is when they're the most contagious. Now, for some people, it can extend beyond that, 10, 14 days in some cases, but we think the majority is within the first 10 days where they're contagious from when their symptoms start.
And then how long after we have had exposure to somebody that is sick will we start to show symptom?
It can be a couple days, or it can be, I think the number is about 97% within 11 days of exposure will have symptoms.
And symptoms can range all across the board, but what are the ones that are really the classic COVID symptoms? And I know some of this is a repeat of what we've talked about before, but I think it's always good to remind people.
So the classic symptoms, sore throat is often, runny nose, shortness of breath, chest pain. People can have headaches. People can have fever and chills. Diarrhea is also added to one of the common symptoms. So those are the most common symptoms that people can have, but it can range anywhere from just some people having some mild shortness of breath to people having what they think is influenza.
And this thing about not being able to taste, is that a pretty telltale sign?
So it is for some people. Most people who lose their sense of taste will often have other symptoms such as a fever, but it's a fairly common one. And the interesting thing is we don't quite know how many people will recover their sense of taste. Again, it's a new virus. We learn more and more all the time, but that's something that we're going to learn down the road, is how many people who completely lose their taste with this will get it back. A lot do initially, but it's those people who seem to have prolonged symptoms. Will it be permanent, or will it resolve over the course of months?
So I know that that once you have been exposed and have COVID, do you have antibodies in your system? Can you explain that, and how long do those last for?
Right. And we talked about that, I think, last time you and I talked about antibody testing, whether we were doing that at Lina. So whenever we get exposed to a virus, we develop antibodies. And we have two kinds of antibodies. We have an IgM, and that's just our immediate reaction and our first antibodies to the virus. And then we have IgG, and IgG is our long-term. Well, that's what makes us immune to something. And for every disease, there's different ways that this happens in terms of the IgG and how long they last. And that's why some things we get it once in our lifetime. And so if we think of some of these childhood diseases that we don't see anymore, like measles and mumps, we get it and we get antibodies and then we're immune. If we think of things like whooping cough that we get vaccinated for, that's something that we lose our antibodies over time and we can get that disease again. So when we talk about antibodies, the problem with COVID is we don't understand how long will we have these antibodies and what do they mean. So we know we get antibodies and we know we can identify them, but we don't know what it's in terms of how much is immunity, how long does it last. At Lina, we have just started as of today. We just started deciding that we have just been allowed to start testing people who we think have COVID whose testing is negative. So when they do the curbside testing and we do the rapid testing, we know it's not 100%. We see people who have the classic symptoms. They say, I can't taste, I feel horrible, I'm coughing, I'm short of breath. Maybe they have a rash, like the rash we've talked about in the past, and yet their COVID test is negative. If we see those people in the clinic and they've had symptoms for at least 14 days, we are testing them for antibodies. And the reason we're doing that is not to say if they're immune, because we don't know what these antibody terms of, does it prevent them from being sick in the past. We don't know. It's not to test and say, well, you had it in March and now you're safe, you don't have to worry. It's for those people where we're trying to figure out what's going on. And if we see those antibodies, that's where it's helpful, because it's not telling us whether or not they can get it again. It's telling us, yes, you've had the disease. And we know that if we test someone 14 to 17 days out, it's 97 to 99% accurate if they have antibodies that they've had the disease in the last few. So we're just starting that just now, and we're gathering data. But again, we're using it for those people that are sick and we can't figure out. It seems like COVID, but their COVID testing has been negative. We know that sometimes we can test someone, and depending how long they've been sick for and how much virus they're shedding, sometimes it can be negative. It's not 100% test. They've done, again, they do lots and lots of studies as we're trying to learn this, and they've done some studies where a patient can test negative one day and then positive the next. It's for those few patients that seem like they have COVID that we just can't figure out, and we're trying to figure out, are we missing something or is this truly COVID? That's where we're going to start right now with the antibody testing. In terms of people wanting to donate plasma, the Red Cross at least previously was testing people when they donated blood if they were considering donating plasma because they thought they had had COVID in the past. And there are some other places that are studying it, but we're not testing for those people who think maybe they had COVID in the past and they want to know.
Are any of the specialty clinics reopening? Some of your specialty doctors see more patients?
Yes, we have moved our respiratory clinic back up to where Melody is, up on Frontage Road, and no longer have a big separation of clinics, and curbside tests moved up there. And so we now have specialists coming back to your clinic. We have cardiology and neurology, and everybody's back except for cardiology is still virtual care and doing telemedicine. But otherwise, we've got age stuff happening at Nininger. And of course, our oncology program and clinic has been going strong the entire time.
When you look at where you are you back up to 100% of what services you had before?
It depends what it is. In our Courage-Kenny rehab areas, it's slower to come back because, as you can appreciate, the social distancing guidelines are strong. And when you're having physio, it's a one-to-one way. So we've had to decrease quite dramatically the number of patients in our Y-based Courage-Kenny open area. So it's back at about 50%. Surgery is back about 80 to 85%. We're still seeing a slow growth back into our emergency room, although on Saturday we saw 48 page day when we normally about 31. So people are coming back. So we're grateful for that, Mo, that people are getting the care that they need.
The clinic is getting busier. We're still trying to balance. Most of our providers, we're asking them to still see at least 25% either virtually or by phone. We closed down our weekend urgent care. I'm sure a lot of people listening know that. And we did that mainly because when COVID started, there really wasn't a demand. People weren't coming in. So we have that plan to start back the first week in August. The emergency room numbers and the demand is enough now that we're going to bring it back. And it simply wasn't reason that there wasn't enough need. And now patients are out more and there are injuries and other things going on and people feel comfortable enough coming in. Obviously, we ask them to mask when they come in. We socially distance. We all wear masks and we wear goggles or face shields and we try and do everything to protect ourselves and to protect our patients so that patients are not put at risk by coming in if they need to seek care.
And what are some things that they can have virtually checked out?
So it really depends on the patient, and it's a complex question. We're still trying to figure it out. I think some of the things are very simple and straightforward. So if someone needs a review of their medication, for example, an antidepressant that we started them on, that's a perfect visit. They don't have to leave their house. They can call us from their car in their parking lot at work just to do a follow-up on their medication. Some of our patients that we see sometimes two or three a year because they have some other medical problems like their diabetes and their hypertension, some of those we can do virtually and some we can't. If their labs have been very stable and they've been very stable, sometimes we can do it virtually. Sometimes we do a virtual visit on that patient and we figure out that they need some lab tests, so we schedule them for a lab-only visit so we don't see them, but we bring them in to have their lab tests and it's just a quick, easy, they've got a scheduled appointment, they come in and they go. And sometimes there's patients that we think will be virtual and then we get on the phone with them and it's like, you know, I think I need to really examine you or I have to look at it. We can do sometimes rashes and those kind of things virtually because if the patient can show us with their computer or with their phone, sometimes we can do it, sometimes we can't. Things like injuries, usually we can't. So if someone has severe abdominal pain, I usually need to press on their belly. Some minor injuries like an ankle sprain, sometimes we can do that virtually. But obviously if someone has an injury where they think they've broken a bone, we need to see them. If they think they have a significant infection in their skin, we need to see them. If they have a high fever and we think that there may be something more serious going on, we need to see those people in person. We need to examine them and we need to do the good old-fashioned medicine of laying hands on them.
But it's so nice to have so many different options.
I was just telling a patient, we were talking about this today, and I said, if you asked any doctor in February if they would be doing all of these visits virtually and doing all of this stuff on the computer without having patients in the office, none of us would have believed it. We never would have believed that we could have done so much of it this way in such an efficient way. And for some patients, very convenient care, especially if they don't live nearby or if they're at work. Doesn't always work, but we're figuring it out.
I love it. You too do have it figured out. Thank you so much. Our guest today, Helen Strike, president of the River Falls Hospital and Regina Hospital, and Dr. Melody McKenzie. She's the primary care lead physician with Allina, also Regina's director of medical affairs. Thank you both so much. I really am grateful for how much information you share with our listeners.
Thank you, Mo.
Thanks, Mo.
Thank you. And you are listening to another edition of Community in Depth on AM 1460 and FM 97.7 KDWA in Hastings.